Chapter 13, Church, by Anthea Butler. God damn America. The words belong to the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the leader of Trinity United Church of Christ, and they ripped through the airwaves in 2008, creating a furor for Senator Barack Obama, who was running to be the United States of America's first black president. Obama had been a member of Wright's congregation for 20 years. He had been married in that Chicago church and had baptized his children there. His relationship to Jesus Christ had solidified in a congregation that, as he later described it, embodied the black community in its entirety, the doctor and the welfare mom, the model student, and the former gangbanger. The title of his 2006 memoir, The Audacity of Hope, was taken from one of Wright's sermons. But the prophetic aspect of Wright's theology, which mounted a direct and forthright critique of American power, would become a problem for Obama. On March 13, 2008, in the middle of his hard-fought Democratic primary with Hillary Clinton, ABC News ran a report called Obama's Preacher, The Wright Message. The segment contained a portion of a Palm Sunday sermon Wright gave in 2003 about the gospel according to Luke and the peril of conflating divine rule with the rule of national governments. Near the end of this sermon, Wright reached a crescendo as he described the plight of black people in America. When it came to treating her citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them in slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of the racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America as long as she keeps trying to act like she is God and she is supreme. The news report aired only the final part of this, Obama's pastor shouting, God damn America, again and again. This critique was unfamiliar to most white Americans, many of whom immediately attacked Wright for being unpatriotic, for sowing seeds of division and hate, and for advocating black separatism. Within 48 hours of the ABC News special, Obama had sent out a statement about Wright's sermon, calling the words of his longtime minister inflammatory and appalling. I reject outright the statements by Reverend Wright that are at issue, he wrote. But it quickly became clear to his campaign that he had to respond more fully to the firestorm. He did so by giving a speech in Philadelphia entitled A More Perfect Union. In that speech, Obama called Wright's sermon incendiary language and went on to say that his pastor's message expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country that sees white racism as endemic and that elevates what is wrong with America above all that we know is right with America. Obama's response seemed to be designed to save his political career by presenting himself as a measured, reasoned man who loved America and did not believe that all white people were racist. His speech was widely praised, and it succeeded in its aims. 3 months later, he won the Democratic nomination, and that November, the presidency. But it also revealed a painful truth. At the moment the nation was preparing to elect its first black leader, the role the black church had played in bringing about that possibility had to be disavowed. The prophetic power of the church had given Obama his soaring speeches and fervor for change, but it was anathema to the political arena of accommodation, especially during an election cycle. For many black Christians, however, Wright's adversarial tone, rooted in a centuries-long quest for justice and righteousness, was not out of the ordinary at all. Wright was an adherent of black liberation theology, a concept developed in the 1960s by James H. Cone, who had been a mentor to Wright. Cone argued that the plight of black Americans must be a central concern of the church. Life-giving power for the poor and the oppressed is the primary criterion that we must use to judge the adequacy of our theology, he declared, not abstract concepts. Cone criticized white Christians for what he saw as their historical failure to fight against slavery, violence, and racial oppression. That failure, he argued, had proved their tradition to be an unrighteous one, out of step with the essence of the gospel. Cone's theology grew out of an even older prophetic tradition. Over the centuries, black preachers in America have used their pulpits, just like Wright did, to challenge the hypocrisy of white America's racism, sometimes with harsh language. Black preaching by historical necessity used the Jeremiad, a rhetorical mode of denunciation or chastisement about the corruption of people, events, or nations that stretches back to the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. More than 2,000 years later, in the antebellum United States, black preachers castigated the nation for the evils of slavery. Preaching in the black church was primarily done by men, in part because of religious prohibitions barring women from the pulpit. And while black preachers generally did not confront the issue of unfairness regarding gender, they repeatedly confronted the moral ills of a society built on chattel slavery. White Protestant Christianity in early American history also inherited the tradition of the Jeremiad, but it was put to different ends, focused on an individual's relationship to God and personal sin and legislating morality. The Puritans gave a special and supernatural legitimacy to the Protestant work ethic in the New World, the scholar Sackvan Berkovich has observed. They raised the success story to the status of visible sainthood. In his book, The American Jeremiad, Berkovich points out that the Puritan Jeremiad was a lament about how the colonists had neglected to seize the opportunity presented by land they had been given in New England. The clergy bewailed, Berkovich writes, the sloth of those who failed to take advantage of this good land whither the Lord has sent us. By contrast, the style of the black church that developed following the Great Awakening and in the antebellum period was one of prophetic witness to the moral outrage of racism in America. It was the rhetoric of dissent, according to Berkovich. David Walker, a 19th century anti-slavery advocate and a member of the AME Church, embraced this approach in his appeal to the colored citizens of the world, excoriating white Christians for their role in the slave trade. They cram us into their vessel holds in chains and handcuffs, men, women, and children all together. Oh, save us, we pray thee, thou God of heaven and of earth, from the devouring hands of the white Christians. In the 20th century, black preachers decried lynching, Jim Crow, segregation, police violence, and other moral ills in America. Martin Luther King Jr.'s leadership in the civil rights movement and his opposition to the Vietnam War exemplified this tradition as well. In a speech at Riverside Church in 1967, he declared that the government of the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. If we do not act, King thundered, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. But the black church has not only been a forum for righteous anger. Forged out of slavery, it was also a place of protection and practicality. For many decades, it was one of the few places black people could gather for educational purposes, to arrange mutual aid groups, or to form political organizations. As a result, it has always been a target. As an independent institution operating free of white control and oversight, the black church had an inherent revolutionary potential that often made it an object of white fear and anger. During the widespread violence that followed emancipation, the Ku Klux Klan burned scores of black churches to the ground, eventually helping to extinguish the promise of Reconstruction. In the buildup to the Wilmington coup in 1898, white citizen patrols harassed black churches where they suspected leaders were conspiring. During the Tulsa Race Massacre in 1921, white people fired machine guns at the Mount Zion Baptist Church. And on September 15, 1963, members of the Ku Klux Klan bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, killing four little black girls and injuring many other people. This long history of violence against black churches continues in our own era. After Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, the pastor of Flood Christian Church repeatedly called out police brutality. One week after Brown's father was baptized at the church, the building was burned to the ground. The following year, the unthinkable happened. Nine members of Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the country's oldest AME congregations, were murdered when a white supremacist named Dylan Roof opened fire on a Bible study group that included Reverend Clementa Pinckney, both the pastor of the church and a state legislator. The murders at Emmanuel AME were devastating. What was also striking to many observers was the speed with which some of the families were willing to forgive Roof. They told him so at his bond hearing just days later. "I forgive you," said Anthony Thompson, whose wife was killed. "My family forgives you," the daughter of Ethel Lance, who was also killed, told Roof. "May God forgive you, and I forgive you." That Sunday, Reverend Norvell Goff Sr. told the congregation, "We still believe that prayer changes things. Prayer not only changes things, it changes us." This spirit of acceptance and forgiveness culminated later in the week when President Obama gave the eulogy for Reverend Pinckney and led the congregation in singing Amazing Grace. The controversy over Reverend Wright's sermon and the horrific attack on Emmanuel AME bookended the presidency of the nation's first Black president, offering the country different perspectives on the Black church. Wright's theology, his understanding of the gospel as fundamentally about justice and standing with the oppressed, represented to many white Americans the threat that the Black church has historically posed to the nation's status quo. For others, it was the correct response to the violence and injustice that Black people continue to face in this country, violence exemplified by the shocking murders at Emmanuel AME 7 years later. The response of some in the congregation following Roof's massacre represented another dimension of the church, a Christian tradition of forgiveness, nonviolence, love, and suffering. To understand how these tendencies have shaped a unique Black American theology, we need to begin where the Black church began, in slavery. The African men, women, and children who were captured and transported to the Americas on slave ships brought with them their own religious beliefs and practices. Some were practitioners of African traditional religions like Yoruba and Vodun. Others were Muslim or Catholic. But they were often seen as heathens by the colonists, who found justification for enslaving them in interpretations of biblical scriptures, most notably Genesis 9:25, the curse of Ham, in which Noah's youngest son, Ham, the father of Canaan, looks upon his father's nakedness and is punished severely. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." Theologians of the Reformation period understood Africans to be the descendants of Canaan and therefore destined to be slaves. Still in the North American colonies, modest numbers of free Black and enslaved people baptized their children and observed other Christian practices, though this was initially limited by English laws that some colonists interpreted as prohibiting the enslavement of Christians. By the second half of the 17th century, new laws had clarified the matter. For instance, one passed in the colony of Virginia in 1667 specified that the conferring of baptism doth not alter the condition of the person as to his bondage. This led to further efforts to introduce the enslaved to Christianity. In 1701, the Church of England founded the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, which evangelized to English colonists and non-Christians, including some enslaved people. Despite the new laws, these missionary efforts alarmed many enslavers who feared that baptism could lead to freedom. The First Great Awakening saw the rise of religious fervor not only among white Americans, but also in both free and enslaved Black people. This revival period, starting in the 1730s, introduced a more emotional and ecstatic religious practice that would also empower the enslaved. In the decades that followed, they would create what Albert Rabiteau describes in his groundbreaking book, Slave Religion, as an invisible institution. There were few formal Black churches at this point, but the enslaved could gather in outdoor spaces and hear from Black preachers an interpretation of Christianity that diverged from the one offered by white churches, which in most cases amounted to slaves ought to be obedient to their masters. The Black preachers in the emerging tradition of Black spirituals contributed to a different understanding of the gospel, one that encouraged and supported a longing for freedom. In the second half of the 18th century, the Methodist Church provided an institutional home for some Black Christians. Though they were segregated from white parishioners, Black Methodists could join congregations, and they soon made up 20% of the church's members in North America. It was in this context that the first visible institutions for Black religious practice began to emerge. In April 1787, just 1 month before the Constitutional Convention gathered in Philadelphia to draft the nation's charter document, two leaders of the city's small community of free Black people, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, founded an aid organization called the Free African Society to help formerly enslaved people get on their feet. Both had been born into slavery themselves, with Allen purchasing his freedom in his early 20s and Jones being manumitted when he was nearly 40 years old. They met at St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church, where Allen, who had been preaching since he was a young man, would sometimes lead services for the small group of Black members. Though the Free African Society was initially a non-denominational organization, it provided services in keeping with the gospel of the church, offering various kinds of aid and support to the many widows, orphans, and sick, injured, or destitute Black people, some of them fugitives from slavery, who were arriving in great numbers in the new nation's capital city during those years. As the population of free Black people in Philadelphia grew, tensions mounted at St. George's over the increasing number of Black parishioners showing up for services. One Sunday in 1792, a dispute arose over where Allen and Jones would sit and pray. In Allen's memoirs, The Life, Experience, and Gospel Labors of the Right Reverend Richard Allen, he describes the incident. Meeting had begun, and they were nearly done singing, and just as we got to the seats, the elder said, "Let us pray." We had not been long upon our knees before I heard considerable scuffling and low talking. I raised my head up and saw one of the trustees, H.M., having hold of Reverend Absalom Jones, pulling him up off of his knees and saying, "You must get up. You must not kneel here." Mr. Jones replied, "Wait until prayer is over." Mr. H.M. said, "No. You must get up now, or I will call for aid, and I force you away." Mr. Jones said, "Wait until prayer is over, and I will get up and trouble you no more." With that, he beckoned to one of the other trustees, Mr. L.S., to come to his assistance. He came and went to William White to pull him up. By this time, prayer was over, and we all went out of the church in a body, and they were no more plagued with us in the church. This raised a great excitement and inquiry among the citizens, insomuch that I believe they were ashamed of their conduct. But my dear Lord was with us, and we were filled with fresh vigor to get a house erected to worship God in. Both Jones and Allen set about raising funds from Black and white Philadelphians to establish churches. Before they could do so, a yellow fever epidemic struck the city. Many of the city's white residents, including Dr. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, erroneously thought that something in the constitution of Black people kept them from catching the virus. So they pressed African Americans into service as nurses, caretakers, and gravediggers. Allen Jones and other members of the Free African Society were instrumental in tending to the city's sick, with Allen himself falling ill and recovering. Others were not so lucky. Still, under the leadership of Allen Jones, the city's Black population performed many noble acts during the crisis. As one Philadelphian wrote in a letter, "I don't know what the people would do if it was not for the Negroes, as they are the principal nurses." Allen preached about the demonstration of Christian charity represented by these selfless acts. Nevertheless, when the virus subsided, Black contributions to the city's survival during the epidemic were contested, erased, and denied, with one white printer going so far as to accuse the city's Black nurses of extorting large fees from their patients and looting their houses. The slander against the city's Black community was so great that Allen and Jones published a response entitled "A Narrative of the Proceedings of the Black People During the Late Awful Calamity in Philadelphia in the Year 1793, and a Refutation of Some Censures Thrown Upon Them in Some Late Publications." Their reputations prevailed, and in 1794, Allen was able to garner enough support to start the Bethel Church in an old blacksmith's shop. That same year, Jones opened the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas. Both churches had grown out of the Free African Society, the founding of which one AME pastor would later refer to as a liberty bell for Black folks. Allen and Jones were not alone in their efforts to establish independent Black churches in some of the nation's northern cities. In the 1790s, a second Great Awakening swept through the country, spreading the gospel even farther. By 1816, black congregations from Baltimore, Attleboro, Pennsylvania, and Salem, New Jersey had joined together with the Philadelphia churches to incorporate the AME denomination with Bethel as its mother church. In 1819, Jerina Lee became the first African-American woman licensed to preach at Richard Allen's invitation. Lee had approached Allen some years prior, but he had declined her request. She would continue to preach after Allen's death and would work with the New York Anti-Slavery Society. Over the next decade, black people founded other AME congregations, primarily in the Northeast and the Midwest, and even as far away as Hispaniola, when, in the 1820s, 6,000 free black people emigrated to Haiti from the United States. From the beginning, these AME congregations demonstrated the crucial role the black church would play in resisting slavery and oppression. God himself was the first pleader of the cause of the slaves, Allen wrote in his autobiography. In 1830, Mother Bethel AME Church was the site of the inauguration of the Colored Conventions movement, gatherings of free black leaders who met to discuss and strategize about educational, political, labor, and legal rights. Allen, then 70 years old, was elected president of the convention, combining the roles of spiritual and political leader in a way that would become common for black clergy. Throughout the 19th century, these conventions, which provided a critical foundation for building a political case for abolition, equality, and black citizenship, were often held in churches. The gospel clearly contained inspiration for the freedom struggle, and not always through peaceful means. In the first few decades of the 19th century, enslaved people, often motivated by religious fervor, regularly joined uprisings led by black spiritual leaders. Denmark Vesey, a free carpenter and a member of Charleston's AME Church, made plans for a rebellion in the city in 1822. After his capture and execution, local white residents burned the church, the same congregation Dylan Roof attacked in 2015, to the ground. Nat Turner, a preacher who believed he had received prophetic visions of Jesus' apocalyptic return, led a rebellion in 1831 that killed 55 white people. After he was captured and executed, along with some 200 freed and enslaved black persons, Virginia enacted laws forbidding black people from attending religious gatherings without white observers present. After emancipation, some black religious figures took a new approach to demanding justice. They ran for political office. One of the first was Henry McNeil Turner, a minister in the AME Church. Born a free man in South Carolina in 1834, Turner joined the church in St. Louis in 1858 and soon after was ordained. In 1863, he played an instrumental role in forming the first black military regiment in the Union Army. There would ultimately be 175. And he served as the first black chaplain commissioned to minister to black troops. At the end of the war, Turner headed south to work for the Freedmen's Bureau and ended up in Georgia, where he planted numerous AME churches. But it was as an elected official that he believed he would have the greatest impact during Reconstruction. In 1868, Turner and more than two dozen other black men in Georgia won races for the state legislature, running as Republicans. In response, white Georgia lawmakers introduced a measure to expel them. Once Turner realized that those white officials had no intention of allowing him or the other newly elected black lawmakers to be seated, he wrote a defiant speech entitled, "I Claim the Rights of a Man." Though it would be voiced from the state house floor, it was very much in the tradition of the Jeremiad, delivered from the pulpit, that had already begun to define the black church in America. In arguing for electoral legitimacy, Turner pinpointed the core issue in the Reconstruction era. The rights white people had were also now available to black people. Many Southern white people rejected this idea entirely. On September 3, 1868, along with other elected black lawmakers, Turner addressed the legislature, demanding that they not be stripped of their elected offices. "If you deny my right, the right of my constituents to have representation here, because it is a privilege, then, sir, I will show you that I have as many privileges as the whitest man on this floor. If I am not permitted to occupy a seat here for the purpose of representing my constituents, I want to know how white men can be permitted to do so. How can a white man represent a colored constituency if a colored man cannot do it? The great argument is, oh, we have inherited this, that, and the other. Now, I want gentlemen to come down to cool common sense. Is the created greater than the creator? Is man greater than God? It is very strange if a white man can occupy on this floor a seat created by colored votes and a black man cannot do it. The speech aroused the ire of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacists. A statement in the Columbus Weekly Sun, a local newspaper, declared that we should be neither seized with anger or regret if Turner were to be lynched. He survived and Congress intervened, compelling the Georgia state legislature to seat the elected black lawmakers, including Turner. But over the next 9 years, Reconstruction would begin to crumble as white politicians, law enforcement, and Christians banded together to push back violently against the autonomy of black people in the South. During this period, known as Redemption, starting in the 1870s, white men embraced a completely different religious rationale to methodically erase the gains of Reconstruction. The white redeemers who overturned Reconstruction claimed they were driven by divine right to bring God's order back to the South. According to the historian Daniel Stowell, redeemers imagined that, like Jesus, they could redeem the South with blood sacrifice and rescue their states from the captivity of Northern and African-American political power. In the words of Carol Emberton in her book Beyond Redemption, disparate movements and agendas simultaneously sought redemption from violence and also through violence. Black families and communities throughout the South, as well as many white people who supported them, were terrorized by waves of ferocious brutality that started almost as soon as the Civil War ended. Frequently, these attacks targeted black churches. One episode took place in Memphis in 1866, when the city's police department, along with a mob of white men, attacked black neighborhoods and contraband camps of formerly enslaved people. The white mob burned down 4 black churches, destroyed 12 schools, killed 46 African Americans, and raped 5 women. In the wake of this violence and with a newfound understanding of the futility of working within the system, Turner evolved in new directions. Discouraged by his experience in politics, he became a bishop in the AME Church and a more radical voice. He had always advocated an accommodationist relationship with white people. Now he began to preach a version of black nationalism, the belief that black people should have their own autonomy, even their own country. He became a proponent of the Back to Africa movement and believed that slavery had existed in order to expose Africans to Christianity. He argued that black people had needed to come in contact with Christian civilization and by intercourse with the powerful white race so that they could fit themselves to go back to their own land and make of that land what the white man had made of Europe and America. Turner would eventually plant churches in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and South Africa. He believed that Christianity would make Africa a great continent if it was brought there by free African Americans in the form of the AME Church, which had already done so much to advance the cause of black liberation in the United States. The traditions arising out of the black 19th century churches and leadership included social uplift, liberation, pragmatism, and black nationalism. All of these and more would prove necessary for black citizens to survive the oppressive laws, terroristic violence, and grinding deprivation of the Jim Crow era. During this period, the church continued to serve as a structure that protected black Americans, supported them, and shielded them from the wrath of white people who refused to see them as equals. But as time went on, it went beyond being a place of refuge and evolved into the primary site of a revolutionary movement. Buttressed by groups like the NAACP, the National Urban League, and the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, the church was the home base of the civil rights movement in the 1950s. It was one of the few places where black people could meet safely, and for leaders of the movement, it offered a connection to prominent people in the community who could provide finances and lodging. When police arrested Rosa Parks on December 1, 1955, for not giving up her seat on the bus, the black community in Montgomery was ready. They had been planning this act of civil disobedience. A group of local ministers and community leaders met at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church to prepare a boycott of the city's buses. They called themselves the Montgomery Improvement Association and elected as the organization's leader the new pastor of the church, a 26-year-old graduate of Boston University's doctoral program in systematic theology named Martin Luther King, Jr. For King, the prophetic confrontation began with the bus boycott, a protest sustained by weekly meetings at the city's churches, where activists would organize carpools and facilitate support from other church groups around the country. The Montgomery bus boycott highlighted King's rhetorical skill as well as his message of nonviolent action. It lasted for just over a year, during which King was arrested and his home firebombed. Speaking after the bombing, King urged his followers to meet violence with nonviolence. Though his message had been honed by his undergraduate mentor Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College, whose study of Gandhian nonviolence influenced King's doctoral work at Boston University, it was also informed by Christian theology. Remember the words of Jesus, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." We must love our white brothers, no matter what they do to us. We must make them know that we love them. Jesus still cries out in words that echo across the centuries. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. This is what we must live by. We must meet hate with love. Remember, if I am stopped, this movement will not stop, because God is with the movement. Go home with this glowing faith and this radiant assurance. The movement attracted young divinity school scholars like James Lawson, a student at Vanderbilt Divinity School, who organized the Nashville sit-ins in 1960, and John Lewis and C.T. Vivian, both divinity students at American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, as well as college students like Diane Nash, who was at Fisk University. The church sat at the center of their activism as a locus of worship and as a community and organizing space for political and social engagement. Numerous actions of this period were born in church basements, meeting rooms, and pews, including the Albany Movement, a desegregation effort in Georgia, the 1961 Freedom Rides, and the Birmingham Campaign. But not all religious leaders agreed on the way forward. King and other ministers who were active in the movement clashed with Joseph Jackson, the longtime leader of the National Baptist Convention, NBC, who was more moderate and resisted getting the convention more involved in civil rights. As a result, in 1961, King and other ministers would split away from the NBC to form the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, and the rise of Black power presented a more serious challenge to the Black church's vision of the path toward freedom. Malcolm X not only ridiculed the philosophy of nonviolence and disparaged the desire for integration, he rejected Christianity as the white man's religion and was a vocal detractor of King. In an interview with Eleanor Fisher in 1961, he explained his denunciation of King's philosophy. "I think any Black man who teaches Black people to turn the other cheek and suffer peacefully after they have been turning the other cheek and suffering peacefully for 400 years in a land of bondage under the most cruel, inhuman, and wicked slave master that any people have been under, he is doing those people an injustice, and he's a traitor to his own people." Malcolm X's articulation of Black nationalism created a growing problem for King and the Christian leadership of the civil rights movement. For generations, the church had been the primary source of Black resistance to white racism and oppression, but Black nationalism unsettled the church's centrality in this struggle. It provided an alternate competing space that affirmed Black life while critiquing white supremacy. The Black Power movement would intensify this dilemma for the Black church. The term Black Power was first used in the context of political activism by Stokely Carmichael, a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. By the mid-1960s, the country was boiling with urban rebellions and police reprisals. Like many activists, Carmichael had begun to feel frustrated with the slow progress of the nonviolent movement, which seemed increasingly out of step with the times. In 1965, during the Watts Rebellion, 34 people had been killed in clashes between the city's Black residents and law enforcement. The following year, Carmichael traveled to Mississippi to take part in a rally for James Meredith, the Black student who had integrated the University of Mississippi and had recently been shot and wounded during his one-man protest, the March Against Fear. Carmichael and some other SNCC members had been discussing introducing the phrase Black Power during the rally. After Carmichael was arrested and then released, he took the stage and addressed the assembled protesters. "We've been saying freedom for 6 years," he said. "What we are going to start saying now is Black Power." This rapidly became a mantra for the younger generation. Black Power was a compelling vision of Black self-determination and a clear repudiation of King's emphasis on nonviolence and integration. "It is a call for Black people in this country to unite," Carmichael explained, "to recognize their heritage, to build a sense of community. It is a call for Black people to define their own goals, to lead their own organizations." It was also far more confrontational. "When you talk of Black Power," Carmichael said, "you talk of building a movement that will smash everything Western civilization has created." King was initially wary of the idea, commenting in public that the slogan was an unwise choice. To his staff, he described Black Power as a cry of pain. "It is in fact a reaction to the failure of white power to deliver promises and to do it in a hurry." But he could not avoid the predicament Black Power created for his movement. Meanwhile, for white churches, Black Power raised a different concern, that perhaps the nonviolence of the civil rights movement would give way to something more aggressive. Alarmed, some white religious leaders criticized the Black Power movement for preaching hatred of white people. In July 1966, the National Council of Churches, an ecumenical body of Black and white Christian churches formed in 1950, met to discuss the turmoil. At the conference, a group of Black pastors within the NCC came together to form an ad hoc committee that would become, later that year, the National Conference of Negro Churchmen. They were faced with complex fractures within the larger organization. On the one hand, they were disturbed by white clergy members who were up in arms about Black Power. On the other, they were also frustrated by the inability of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference to respond effectively to the violence of the urban rebellions. Meanwhile, SNCC, under the leadership of Carmichael, had fully embraced the Black Power movement, and Carmichael's stature was rising. The Black pastors who came together at the NCC that year sought to navigate the tension between Black Power and the Christian tradition. On July 31, 1966, following the conference, the group took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. Their statement began, "We, an informal group of Negro churchmen in America, are deeply disturbed about the crisis brought upon our country by historic distortions of important human realities in the controversy about Black Power. What we see shining through the variety of rhetoric is not anything new, but the same old problem of power and race which has faced our beloved country since 1619. We realize that neither the term power nor the term Christian conscience is an easy matter to talk about, especially in the context of race relations in America. The fundamental distortion facing us in the controversy about Black Power is rooted in a gross imbalance of power and conscience between Negroes and white Americans." The statement challenged the power imbalance between white men and Black men, but it also addressed how the Black church had been created as a result of the refusal to submit to the indignities of a false kind of integration in which all power was in the hands of white people. Laying out the reasons why Black Power was important in the moment of struggle, the ministers declared that America is our beloved homeland, but America is not God. As in the sermon from Reverend Wright that caused trouble for Obama, the clergyman's statement asserted that America is not to be equated with God and that America can be culpable for the injustices done to Black people throughout the nation's history. The statement was a direct influence on a young Black theologian named James Cone. It highlighted the tension between the church's traditional role as a home base of Black resistance and the rising Black Power movement and set the stage for Cone's theology, which would find a way to integrate the two approaches. Cone recalled, "I shouted for joy when I read that statement because it showed that prophetic voices were still present in the Black church." For Cone, a newly minted PhD from Northwestern University, the statement spoke to his own disappointments with the civil rights movement, as well as his growing anger about the failures of white Christians to understand the systemic racism and injustices in America. Cone was struggling to bring together the theological, ethical, and social implications of the Black church's centuries-long struggle for justice and civil rights at a moment in which that tradition had been plunged into crisis. The uncompromising moral vision of the Black Power movement offered a persuasive answer to a series of questions the Black church was having trouble addressing. As Cone put it, the Black church was thus faced with a theological dilemma: either reject Black power as a contradiction of Christian love and thereby join the white church in its condemnation of Black power advocates as un-American or un-Christian, or accept Black power as the social political truth of the gospel. Cone's resolution of this dilemma was Black theology. He presented the idea in his first book, Black Theology and Black Power, published in 1969, just a year after King was assassinated in Memphis. While the gospel itself does not change, he wrote, every generation is confronted with new problems, and the gospel must be brought to bear on them. Cone sought to reclaim the gospel from a tradition he saw as having become too accepting of the evils of racism. Black power, he declared, was not some heretical idea, but rather Christ's central message to 20th century America. And unless the empirical denominational church makes a determined effort to recapture the man Jesus through a total identification with the suffering poor, as expressed in Black power, that church will become exactly what Christ is not. Cone's argument was that God is principally concerned with the suffering of the poor and the oppressed, beginning with the Israelites in Egypt. In America, the poor and the oppressed were Black. Therefore, the salvation of Black Americans had to be the central preoccupation of the church. Cone's vision not only recognized the struggles of Black people as the point of departure for a new theology, but also called to account the manner in which white churches had been instrumental in upholding the structures of racism. It seems that the white church is not God's redemptive agent, he wrote, but rather an agent of the old society. Most church fellowships are more concerned about drinking or new buildings or Sunday closing than about children who die of rat bites or men who are killed because they want to be treated like men. It was a scathing indictment of white racism, and it brought together the call for justice that King and others in the civil rights movement had made with Black power's call for Black agency and self-determination. Black Theology and Black Power was published 3 months before another statement from the group of pastors who had come together at the 1966 NCC. They now called themselves the National Conference of Black Churchmen, and their statement opened with a section entitled, Why Black Theology? The group articulated how Cone's liberatory vision for the Black church, influenced by the rise of Black power, was rooted in its long history of fighting to protect and redeem Black Americans. The Black church has not only nurtured Black people, but enabled them to survive brutalities that ought not to have been inflicted on any community of men, they wrote. Black theology is the product of Black Christian experience and reflection. It comes out of the past. It is strong in the present, and we believe it to be redemptive for the future. The following year, Cone published his second book, A Black Theology of Liberation. The book would make him a major expositor of Black liberation theology. It was a heady time for liberation theologies. The Dominican priest Gustavo Gutierrez published his book on Catholic liberation theology in 1971. In both the Protestant and the Catholic worlds, theological emphasis on liberation would become a major theme. Much of this emphasis was due to the influence of the civil rights movement in the United States and the central role of the Black church in that movement. Liberation theology in any national context, as Cone says, is an interpretation of the Christian gospel from the experience and perspectives and lives of people who are at the bottom in society, the lowest economic and racial groups. Cone became a professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, the former academic home to Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich, major Protestant theologians of the 20th century. Training students for both the clergy and the academy, Cone's teaching and advocacy would span more than 30 years and were a major influence on people like Reverend Wright. Cone's thinking influenced the political world, too, perhaps most directly through one of his students, Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia. Warnock, who was born into a Black Pentecostal family, followed his father into the ministry. His dissertation with Cone turned into a book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, Theology, Piety, and Public Witness, which deals with the tension in the Black church between piety and social justice and the public response to that conflict. For Warnock, the Black church has exemplified both radical and unradical tendencies. It has been at once the most prominent instrument of liberation within the African American community and the foremost conservative custodian of an uncritical evangelical piety that undermines the aims of liberation. Today, Warnock stands as a bridge between the Black church, past, present, and future, and political action. What he learned from Cohn is not simply what the theology of Black liberation is, but how to be socially active and apply that to his ministry. Warnock's first pastorship was at Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore. Then in 2005, he was appointed senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, King's Family Church in Atlanta. His career since then has exemplified the civil rights work and prophetic tradition that King embodied, along with the spirit of Cohn's Black liberation theology. Warnock was arrested in the U.S. Capitol building in 2017 for leading a prayer in the rotunda protesting the health care cuts in then-President Trump's budget. Even before that, he was socially active, taking an HIV test in front of his congregation to affirm testing in the Black community. His election to the U.S. Senate in 2020 made him the first African-American senator from Georgia, the same state that had refused to seat Henry McNeil Turner after he was elected to the legislature in 1868. Warnock's race for that Senate seat pitted him against Kelly Loeffler, who campaigned against him by distorting a sermon he preached in 2011 in which he said, "America, nobody can serve God and the military. You can't serve God and money. You cannot serve God and mammon at the same time. America, choose ye this day who you will serve." The sentiment was straight out of the Bible, Matthew 6:24. But Loeffler highlighted the first sentence, "America, nobody can serve God and the military," and used it to paint Warnock as radical and unsupportive of U.S. troops. It was a technique out of the same playbook used to vilify King, Wright, and other Black preachers who had confronted the broken promises of America. This time, however, it didn't succeed. Warnock won a special election to the U.S. Senate on January 5, 2021, the day before the failed Capitol insurrection. Loeffler and other Republicans claim that Warnock's radical liberalism was evident from his commitment to prophetic preaching. But Jonathan Lee Walton, the dean of Wake Forest University School of Divinity, more accurately describes that preaching as stemming from a deep love for, and thus a deep disappointment in, a country that too often fails to affirm the self-evident truth in our nation's creed that all people are created equal and endowed by God with certain unalienable rights. That deep love accompanied by deep disappointment is what drives the Black church today, and leaders such as Senator Warnock continue to carry forward the tradition of speaking truth to power in the Black church. Others have eschewed the formal Black church tradition and have looked to Black Lives Matter, Color of Change, and other social justice movements to call America's failings to account. Yet, the Black church remains the prophetic voice of condemnation of America's ills. As King so aptly stated in his "I Have a Dream" speech, "America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds." The Black church, pastors and members alike, is still demanding to cash the check of true democracy and freedom.